This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. We appreciate you joining us. Here we are, Trumpet Hour Week in Review time. Our panel of writers is eager to discuss the important events of this past week. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Good to be with you.
And Andrew Miller.
Great to be here.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
Shalom.
Great to have you guys here. A dramatic terrorist attack occurred in London on Wednesday. We talked about it on thetrumpet.com and on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Also, if you're a subscriber to our Trumpet Brief email service, which I would encourage you to become, you learned about this as well. There's more information now coming out about the attack and the attacker. And for this story, we're going to go straight to our man in Britain, Richard.
Yes, we now know the name of the attacker. We're getting a better picture of exactly what happened. His name is Khalid Massoud. He is British-born. He was born with the name Adrian. He later, it seems, converted to Islam. He kind of ended up with a life in and out of jail, and it's believed that he converted to Islam and was kind of radicalized within jail in Britain. He then traveled to Saudi Arabia and spent a few years there before coming back and then ultimately committing this terrorist attack. He rented a car from Birmingham, not too far from where I am. He drove down to London, knocked over a bunch of people, wounded at least 50, 31 requiring hospital treatment, killed five, and rammed the gates of Parliament, and then tried to go and stabbed a policeman and eventually was shot. So that's a summary of what we know at the moment. Unfortunately, it's kind of a depressingly familiar story. It's a very similar story to the one we've seen all across Europe. And that's what happened.
So Brad McDonald talked about this on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show on Thursday and was just focusing on Theresa May's response. We just need to go about our regular lives, return to life as normal. You mentioned how depressingly familiar this is becoming. Not so much specifically in Britain, although there have been a few attacks. We've had some knife attacks and things. But really, across Europe, this type of situation where you have individuals who have been radicalized, either native, who've been radicalized within their countries or visiting from outside, but the same ideology that's inspiring them. What has been Britain's response as more of these details have come out, and it is more apparent that this is the same threat that is surfacing again and again?
Yeah, I mean, it's still been exactly as Mr. McDonald discussed yesterday. I mean, it's from what I've seen, it's just kind of like, what can you do? This happens sometimes. I mean, in some ways, yeah, it's going to take something a lot bigger than this to really shock London. I mean, we had Martin McGuinness died this week. He was an IRA terrorist, and he was behind a whole bunch of attacks and murders, and his organization killed a whole bunch more people in London during the 90s and the 80s and throughout Britain. So it's going to take a lot more than killing four people, I think, or five people now to really kind of produce a sense of crisis. But it has just been a depressingly, it's just kind of like, well, what can you do? Let's keep everything in proportion. I have seen people blaming Google.
Right.
The Daily Mail and the front page are saying it's Google's fault because they don't police the internet well enough, apparently. They then actually went on to quote large tracts of what they were blaming Google for making available in their own article. But I haven't seen any really discussion at all of, okay, well, what do we need to change to make things different? How do we stop this? Why are British-born Muslims being radicalized? Why is our prison system operating this way, where you get criminals, and you see this again across Europe, where you get criminals end up being turned into violent jihadists as they kind of progress their way through the criminal system? Why even do we have young men like this that end up just going in and out of prison, in prison for a couple of years for stabbing someone in the face, out again, and then they stab somebody else in the face, and then they're just in for a little bit and back out again? Why are those problems there? I mean, it kind of touches on a whole bunch of different basic problems, but nobody really seems to be discussing those. It's just kind of, you know, well, you can't stop people killing people with cars. We need to put a few more bollards up. We shouldn't have let this particular vulnerability be there at Parliament, and let's just focus on all the nice things people did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is another big angle I haven't seen covered this time. I did see just one or two articles on it several years ago after the London train bombing, about just how like American and British culture really no longer offers like a bigger vision that inspires people, leading to some of this, like said, homegrown radicalism, not necessarily people who've even immigrated here from other countries, but like British or American youth who are becoming radicalized in some of these ideologies like Islam. Where they said, like back in the time of the British Empire, when you're actually exporting like British cultural values, democratic values, human rights values around the world, youth viewed themselves as part of something bigger. And then, especially since the 60s, where you kind of got like this cultural self-loathing that has set in across these Anglo-American nations, where you get so many who are like ashamed of their past, ashamed of their culture, that does kind of create almost like a moral desperation that makes something like Islam that it's crazy.
More
some of its ideas are the fact that it does at least purport to have pride in its culture and solutions that it thinks will fix the world, that you does pull over some of the youth that they're like, well, maybe it's worth a shot if they think they can fix some of these problems instead of just being ashamed of everything you've ever stood for.
Yeah, you see exactly. I mean, we've seen the same evidence of that with the Scottish referendum, and Mr. MacDonald made that point when he wrote about the first referendum, and it looked when the Scots were doing, yes, way better than anyone expected in the polls. It's the same kind of fundamental weakness of just a lack of purpose and reason and vision behind what the nation is there to achieve. And you see it manifesting itself in different ways. I mean, there's just a whole host of fundamental problems that this touches on. And it is depressing just how quickly everyone just is wanting to move on and not, I mean, it's not pleasant to think about it, but nobody really does want to do that.
Well, we'll go ahead and leave that there and transition to another area. We're talking about just the appeal of Islam for its actually having a purpose and a vision, and really Iran has positioned itself as the leader of radical Islam in the Middle East, certainly, and it continues to build its credentials and power in that respect. For years, we've shown how it's going to fulfill a biblical prophecy as the king of the South. And one way it's securing its position is by gaining control of the Red Sea. We've tracked its efforts to establish a foothold on the Arabian Peninsula in the country of Yemen. It's supporting a Houthi group there, a group that's rebelling against the Yemeni government. Many analysts have downplayed Iran's involvement with this group, but more evidence emerged this week underscoring the Trumpet's view and showing just how robust Iran's support of this group has been. For this, we're going to go to our man in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, like you said, our eyes have been on this for some time, and it's getting really repetitive for me over here writing articles about it, but we just can't underscore this fact enough, just how much Iran is moving in the Saudi in the peninsula there in Yemen to try and stop or limit and jeopardize shipping through this Red Sea passageway. It's so important, and there is a lot of, just going back 2 years or 3 years, there's not many people that talked about how Iran was directing, sponsoring the Houthis. No, not too many people were saying that. Even the United States government's position was, while Iran was that Iran might be giving them some arms, it's really hard to tell. They're definitely not underneath Iran's thumb. They're definitely not acting behind directives directly from Iran. And yet, going back to when they took over the country, our editor-in-chief, he said that this wasn't some grassroots rebellion. This was a plan that was being implemented by Iran to mobilize these Houthis. And there's been more and more evidence that's come out. Just this past week, the latest bit of evidence comes from Reuters, who is a news agency quite well-credentialed news agency who's not just going to write about any wind, a bit of wind or a bit of news that they hear. They said that just last month there was a very important meeting that took place in Tehran involving Major General Qassem Soleimani, the head of the Quds Force, the part of the IRGC that is involved in foreign battles. They had a meeting. Well, he had a meeting with his general staff, and it was to look at ways to further empower the Houthis. At this meeting, they agreed to increase the amount of help through training, arms, financial support, all these ways. They're going to, right now, increase the aid that they've already given them.
So this is, like you said, this is something that we've been talking about, but for Reuters to uncover this, and show just how robust that support has been. Actually, maybe you could just take us through some of the other evidence that shows just how involved Iran has been here, and evidence that maybe Western governments have wanted to kind of look the other way about.
Yeah, on thetrumpet.com, we've been talking about this going back to 2009, how much Iran was trying to destabilize Yemen. And back then, Yemeni security forces, they uncovered 6 weapons caches belonging to the Houthis that had short-range missiles that were made in Iran. Then 2010, the Yemen Navy seized an Iranian ship loaded with anti-tank weapons destined for a port in northwest Yemen. That's where the Houthis are. And 6 of those crew members were weapons experts. It's interesting that according to Memory is the Middle Eastern Research Institute, and they look at Arabic sources and they translate them to English, and that's just to help us to see to help us to understand the chatter. And one of the things they found out is that Iran has been sending 100 Houthi fighters to Tehran, then from there they get flown into Beirut, then in Lebanon, then they get transported to the Syrian battlescape, and then they train with IRGC soldiers in Syria. 100 of these have been do it each month. Up to right now, there have been 3,000 Houthi soldiers that have been trained by the IRGC, and that was from March 2015. So that's probably even increased. And then in the past 2 years, we've had American, Australian, and then I think it was a French. All their navies have intercepted ships carrying weapons destined for the Houthis made in Iran inside the Red Sea. So it seems to be a lot of proof. And even, I think it was Mr. Marco Rubio just talking about this 2 weeks ago for a Senate subcommittee. He said, whenever we see Iran sending weapons or we see Iran's involvement pick up in Yemen, it directly correlates to Houthi attacks. So there is a very clear connection between Iran and this terrorist group.
Go online to thetrumpet.com. You can read Brent's article on this, Reuters, Iran increasing support for Yemen's Houthis. And it gives an even more comprehensive list of Iran's activities there. Definitely something to keep our eyes on. And this Reuters report is no shock to anybody who's been reading The Trumpet for any length of time. We appreciate that, Brent. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our Week in Review program. Another dramatic fulfillment of biblical prophecy has been the coming together of two nations, formerly enemies, Russia and China. Prophecy is clear that this alliance would happen, and as unlikely as it would have seemed in recent decades, it's coming together very rapidly. Here's a headline from this week. Military cooperation between Russia and China hits 3-decade high. To learn more about this, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, this cooperation is now soaring to historic heights. There was a report published on Monday. It was by the U.S.-China Economic and Security Review Commission, and it said that as Russia and China keep on pushing their military cooperation to new levels, it's posing a direct threat to America's air superiority in the Asia-Pacific region. So the most recent increase has happened just since Chinese President Xi Jinping came into power back in 2012. Ever since he came into that position, the Chinese military and the Russian armed forces have been staging increasingly frequent and increasingly complex joint military exercises. And the drills have also started to expand quite a bit in terms of their geographic scope. It's covering a larger area all the time. And that just shows that Moscow and Beijing have increasingly aligned security interests. And all of these joint military exercises have also opened the door for much more frequent meetings between senior level Russian and Chinese authorities. And these kinds of meetings and contacts have led to a huge increase in arms deals and in coordinating regional goals and things like that. Russia is now selling a dizzying amount of weaponry to China. Just in December of 2015, Russia started to deliver its Su-35 fighter jets to China. And then beginning in about 8 months, Russia will start to deliver its S-400 surface-to-air missile systems to China. And so all of this adds up to really just extend Beijing's reach, especially across the Taiwan Strait, and just to threaten the air assets of America and its allies in the South China Sea, the East China Sea, and elsewhere in the region. One major milestone in this cooperation came in May of 2016, when Russia and China held their first ever joint missile defense exercise. And now they have another of those planned for sometime this year, an unnamed date so far this year. But both Russia and China are really staunchly opposed to U.S. influence in the region, and specifically America's Terminal High Altitude Air Defense, or THAAD, missile defense system, which is there in South Korea. We've talked about that on a recent episode. Mm-hmm. And so it seems like as that system gets nearer to being operational, that THAAD system, it's prompting a whole new wave of increase in this cooperation between Moscow and Beijing. So it just seems like they want more than ever to be able to present kind of a unified front against this U.S. system and America's general influence.
You know, it seems almost we've seen so many headlines. It's been so steady over the last couple of years, just how this cooperation is increasing. Maybe you could just put it into a little bit of context, just how recent this has been, how unusual it is, because you're talking about the alignment of their security interests, and it seems like just their approach to things in general and their anti-American stance and some of those major pillars of this cooperation have been there for a while. But this really hasn't been the case for you know, in recent years between Russia and China like we're seeing now.
That's true, yes. In very recent history, Russia and China perceived each other as adversaries. In the 50s and 60s, especially when you had Khrushchev and Chairman Mao, the two were in direct competition with each other to sort of figure out who would become the leader of the communist world. Mm-hmm. Mao thought that Khrushchev was ridiculous because he wanted to not do everything he could to destroy the West. And so they really disliked each other in a way that erupted into some huge border clashes in the early 60s. And at that time, it would have been ludicrous to think that some sort of partnership would develop between these two nations, just because the animosity between them was so robust. But, you know, in recent years, we've seen the West begin to isolate Russia a little bit more over the Crimean annexation and mm-hmm. things like that. We've seen these two men, Putin, of course, and Xi, just both sort of share an ideological disdain for the U.S. that seems to override any sort of distrust that remains between Russia and China. So it's just a matter of their goals being to end this era of kind of U.S. Unipolarity, I guess you would say, ever since the collapse of the Soviet Union. And so because of that, all of those old border skirmishes and things like that have just shriveled into insignificance. And, mm-hmm. and now all of their goals to end the U.S. leadership of the world is very much at the forefront, that just kind of trumps all of that.
Well, if you go to thetrumpet.com, you can learn a whole lot more about this trend. We actually have a booklet called Russia and China in Prophecy that explains in detail the biblical passages that inform this view, that even back into the 50s and 60s that Jeremiah was just describing, when there was a lot more animosity between these two countries, that was the prophecy. That was what you were hearing from the Trumpet's predecessor, The Plain Truth. There's even a chapter in the He Was Right booklet on that, which goes back and traces those prophecies back quite a few decades. So we appreciate that, Jeremiah. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. Last weekend in Germany, the finance ministers from the world's leading 20 economies met, and they gave in to a demand by the United States that any joint statement that they made would not mention free trade. Analysts say that this represented a fundamental shift in what has really been central to global economics for years. We talked about it on our Wednesday program. To bring you up to speed, if you missed that program, we're going to turn now to Andrew Miller.
Right. Well, joint statements from the G20 are kind of by their nature usually a little dry and a little boring. But this year is really – it is a historic turning point, a kind of almost a rupture that they haven't really seen since World War II. I mean, since World War II, there's really just kind of been a consensus that the Western world was going to try to integrate with like free trade and free economic exchange. And so this year, they actually have struck all mentions to free trade from their joint policy document. Shockingly, actually came at America's insistence. Normally, America was, after World War II, is kind of like the dominant power in the Western world, the one that was really insisting that we wanted to promote free trade and integrate economies as a way to kind of establish peace in the Western world. And it is a bit of a complex topic, in that the Trump administration has definitely been very critical of a lot of the trade policies America's had for the past several decades, and in many cases, rightfully so. Free trade kind of conjures up the image that it's free. There's not regulation. There's not tariffs. Although in practice, a lot of the free trade agreements are actually there's a lot of extra regulations that we have to abide by in order to get those tariffs low, which has caused some trade agreements like with China and other nations, though we've been running huge trade deficits as other nations export and then we don't export back to them, which leads to debt. So that's, I think, kind of what the Trump administration is trying to do, is to torpedo some of these huge free trade agreements and try to work with other nations more on a bilateral consensus. But of course, the risk is if those other 19 nations in that G20 group start to not like that approach, and they start forming agreements with each other, but not with the United States, you get a case where there still is not necessarily free trade, but trade blocks, huge trade blocks, even a trade block that encompasses most of the world except for the United States.
Right, and there's already evidence showing that's exactly what they're trying to do. We've been talking about that quite a lot over the past couple of weeks. The cover story of our new Trumpet is trade wars have begun. And so even though they acquiesced at this particular meeting, we don't expect that this is going to be the end of the picture.
Right, because some of these big nations like China and like Germany, I mean, they're huge trade powers and they're export-based economies. They export far more than they import. And so it's definitely advantageous for them to be able to cut down on trade barriers that make it easier for them to export. So now the United States is kind of realizing that we're running up some trade deficits because we buy more from other nations than we sell to them. And so they're trying to get some policies to try to fix that. But you could see how a nation like China or Germany is not going to like losing all this great export market they've had for years. And if they can find other trade partners, that can really boomerang on you.
Yep. Well, look for that article, the cover story of our April edition, Trade Wars Have Begun, by Brad McDonald. You can find that on thetrumpet.com. We appreciate that, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, we're going to talk about who's going to rule Iraq when the battle for Mosul ends, the reason why Taiwan is having to build its own submarines, a first within Germany that shows its hardening approach toward terrorism, and the radical left's underhanded attack on Supreme Court Justice nominee Neil Gorsuch. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
The Islamic State established itself in the Iraqi city of Mosul, And last October, an array of forces began working in earnest to drive this terrorist group out of that city. American troops, the Iraqi military, Iraqi federal police, various militias, some of which were backed by Iran. Now, the battle of this city is entering its final stages, and the question is, once the Islamic State is driven out, who will rule Mosul? Longtime followers of the Trumpet should have a very good idea what we expect the answer to that question to be, because we've been forecasting the outcome for Iraq for over 20 years. To learn about this and to hear the answer to that question, we're going to go back to Jerusalem and Brent Noctegal.
So this fight in the city of Mosul is very important. It's the last stronghold that Islamic State has inside Iraq, northern Iraq, and really, once this city is taken, and it's only a matter of time, they're about two-thirds the way through removing the Islamic State from this city, then Iraq is done with the Islamic State. And we've talked a lot about how much Iran is going to take advantage to this of this situation. And it really does, highlights, this fight in Mosul highlights just how much Iran has already influenced the fight against the Islamic State in Iraq, and the fact that they stand to benefit the most once the Islamic State leaves. Now, we've been talking a lot on this show for the past year and a half, 2 years, about how the Islamic State is going to lead to Iran taking over Iraq, because their fighters, their Shiite militias that they control, are needed in the fight against the Islamic State. And now it seems that there are a whole host of other sources that are coming up with this similar scenario, with wondering whether the situation we have post-Islamic State from Iraq is going to be any better than the Islamic State being or functioning within that territory. So there are a number of stories that have been out this past week, or even in the past few weeks, looking at Mosul, and they seem to believe that after this, after the Islamic State goes, then there's going to be a big decision time for the United States and Iran, because who's going to take over the spoils, or who's going to have the spoils, who's going to maintain control of that territory? Al Monitor, which is one of the premier news agencies that writes on Middle Eastern affairs, they said this was just this past week, given that Tehran supports large parts of the PMU, that is the Popular Mobilization Units, the largest conglomerate of Shiite militias there, in fighting in this battle. While given that Tehran supports large parts of the PMU, both military and financially, the PMU's presence in the Mosul operation has undoubtedly caused concern in Washington about the possible expansion of Iran's influence in Iraq. Yes, it does. But it doesn't just cause concern for the U.S. It really has a big cause of concern for the Russians, a big cause of concern for the Israelis as well. That once Islamic State goes, once this Battle of Mosul is ended, here you have Iran coming in.
We've been saying this is exactly what's going to happen, and the way that Iran has used the rise of the Islamic State in order to position itself as an ally of Western powers that are trying to eliminate the Islamic State, and then to pick up the spoils after that cleanup effort is done, is really masterful. But we have been saying this is what's going to happen for years. I mean, in one sense, it's quite extraordinary that the West finds itself in this position, or that it's caught off guard in any way whatsoever by the fact that this is what is happening here.
Yeah, it's absolutely surprising that this is the case. We should have seen it coming. Iran has always coveted Iraq, and we've even documented some evidence in the past of how it looks like Iran allowed the Islamic State. They might not have funded it, but they allowed it to grow in certain areas so that they would be called upon in the fight, knowing that they are the only ones that are willing to use their own ground forces and mobilize their religious militias in this fight, so that they, once the Islamic State goes, you've still got these militias located in that territory, armies armed to the teeth, hundreds of thousands of men, or 100,000 men is how big this PMU is, and they answer to Iran, and they're going to be taking up their ranks inside Iraq here once Islamic State goes. That gives Iran a lot of opportunity. I just want to quote now from Jonathan Speier. He was in Mosul, I guess it was about a month ago, and he was looking at on the front lines, watching this battle take place. And he's probably the best commentator out there, I believe, on the Middle East. And he says, he said this. He said, as the Islamic State gets ready for its last stand in Western Mosul, it is plain to see that the real winners of what is to come are the independent structures of power the Iranians are building inside Iraq. The Iranians are building their powers of structure right now with the forces they have in Iraq. And then he says that most visibly, they're most visibly manifest in these popular mobilization units. Then he quotes a Mosul refugee at one of the camps outside Mosul. And this refugee told him, quote, Iran has its hands all over Iraq. Iraq's in the bag. That's what we said years ago. We had that on the front cover of the Trumpet. I forget when that was. Iraq's in the bag of Iran. And sure enough, with the defeat of the Islamic State from Mosul, it will be complete.
It's something that anybody who's followed the Trumpet for any length of time has to be amazed to see this happen. I'd really encourage people to go onto thetrumpet.com, look for this article about this, and we have links to past articles and the things that we've said about this in years past. Going back to 1994, this is before the United States was even involved in, I mean, years before Saddam Hussein fell and it opened the door for Iraq to fall under Iran's influence the way that we're seeing happen here. At any rate, we appreciate you bringing that story to us, Brent. Taiwan is feeling pretty lonely these days. This island nation is sitting in the shadow of China, which is growing more and more powerful, as we talked about in the last segment, which considers Taiwan a breakaway province. The United States has backed away from supporting Taiwan, as have other nations that basically don't want to upset China. And this week, we got an idea of just what kind of predicament this is putting Taiwan in as it tries to safeguard its own security. For this story, we're going to go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yeah, Taiwan is, of course, an island nation. And so submarines are a key part of its defense strategy, especially since China has been so belligerent lately in the seas around Taiwan and other parts of the region. And right now, Taiwan has for decades been stuck with just four submarines. Two of those were built for the U.S. Navy during World War II. And then the other two were built by the Netherlands and delivered to Taiwan back in 1988. So it's a tiny and fairly geriatric submarine force by any kind of modern standards. And so Taiwan has been trying for, it looks like, around 20 years to try to work with all the usual nations that specialize in exporting non-nuclear attack submarines, nations like France, Germany, Japan, and Russia, and some others. But none of these nations, which build submarines for countries around the world, will build them and sell them to Taiwan. And there's one simple reason why. These countries don't want to risk angering China. Taiwan and Taiwan's status is what China calls a core interest. China views Taiwan not as a sovereign, independent country, but just as kind of a breakaway state that's destined to soon become an official part of China once again. And pretty much the entire world gives in to China on this view. In fact, if you look at the United Nations list of countries, there's 193 countries on that list, but Taiwan's not one of them. Mm-hmm. They, you know, the UN doesn't recognize Taiwan as independent, and most of the other nations around the world, or most nations, follow this lead. And so these countries know that if they were to work with Taiwan on something like attack submarines, they would be incurring China's wrath. They would be risking having China take some kind of retaliatory economic actions against them, or some other even more serious actions of some kind. So they refuse to sell submarines to Taiwan. They refuse to take Taiwan's perfectly good dollars. And Taiwanese authorities have also reached out to the United States for attack submarines. The U.S. has supported Taiwan for as long as its people fled mainland China and set up the country back in 1949. And really, it's only because of American military backing that China hasn't officially swallowed up Taiwan for all these years. But the U.S. has also kind of quietly refused to build submarines for them. In the case of America, it may partly be because Taiwan wants diesel-powered submarines, and America generally only makes nuclear-powered ones. But American leaders still could easily find some kind of a compromise, mm-hmm. if they wanted to, and they could find some way to help Taiwan. But they haven't, because they haven't wanted to risk upsetting the very delicate U.S.-China relationship.
Now, that's what you just said, that it's because of the relationship with China. That's just looking at the situation and making a rational conclusion from what you see there. But the United States' relationship with Taiwan, it has gotten cooler in recent years. They've really backed away from that strong support that they had in past years.
That's right. Yes, ever since the Clinton administration back in the 90s, there's been some alarming statements and actions that the Taiwanese take as just very sobering indications that they can't really rely on American backing the way they thought that they always could. Mm-hmm. And then President Trump has even mentioned using Taiwan's status as a bargaining chip with China, which that was terrifying to the Taiwanese to hear that their status as a sovereign nation is suddenly on some sort of a geopolitical chessboard, mm-hmm. and could be moved around to help America boost its, trade relations.
Leverage
with China.
Against China.
Yes. Yeah. So anyway, this week, Taiwan finally said, since no one will help us and since China is getting more and more pushy, and China already has 53 attack submarines, and we'll have 78, they say, by 2020, which is just a couple of years away. So the Taiwanese president said, we will be launching a homegrown attack submarine program. That was on Tuesday. President Tsai Ing-wen said the need is very urgent and nobody is willing to help us. So we will learn how to do this really sophisticated and advanced weapons development. So it's a really glaring indication of China's power and of how much even the global powers in Europe fear China. And also of just how vulnerable Taiwan is to Beijing.
That's quite a story, yeah, Andrew.
Yeah, I can say too. It's supposed to be a really dangerous time if you don't have other nations backing you, and China doesn't want to see them build 70 submarines to counter their 70 submarines. So, I mean, that could even be
provocation.
A big catalyst to cause China to do something. I know I've read several defense analysts that say that you talk to like Chinese generals who are like the most rational people you ever meet until the topic of Taiwan comes up, and all of a sudden they're spouting off rhetoric about nuclear warfare.
Yeah, I think there's no touchier issue almost in China than Taiwan.
Yeah, Richard, you have a comment?
Yeah, well, just to illustrate some of the global ramifications of this kind of refusal of America to stand up for Iran that Jeremiah was talking about this morning in the kind of the headline section of our website where we link to good articles elsewhere. We put up one from Real Clear Defense that talks about China's deep involvement in Djibouti and that in the Red Sea and the Bab el-Mandeb Strait, how they're building a naval base right there where you've got, I think, something like 4% of global oil trade going through. And it was making the case that the reason why China is able to project its power that far and to be able to threaten such a vital sea lane that's so far from the Chinese mainland is because these other nations, they see a United States that's afraid to confront China. And so they think, well, we need to come up with an accommodation. And so Djibouti thinks, well, we need to have a deal. China's a rising power. We need to make a deal with them. And this article was just making the point that it's America's weakness in places like the South China Sea and Iran that is enabling China to spread its influence around the world in a way that really affects American core interests and Americans and everybody around the world.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you for that story, Jeremiah. And we're going to go over to Richard now. And a first for the nation of Germany, they're going to deport two German-born individuals, two men who are suspected of plotting terrorist attacks. They haven't done anything, but the suspicion is there. And it's an indication of just how tough Germany is getting in its approach to terrorism. For this story, we'll go over to Richard.
Yes, I'm certainly not going to be defending these two men that maybe have not been considering a specific attack, I think is what was said, but they, they had a gun, they had an Islamic State flag. But it is part of an important trend we're seeing in Germany, where Germany is starting to come around and kind of move away from this human rights kumbaya way of dealing with terrorism to something that's more realist and more serious. So we're seeing them, for the first time in history, deport two people that were born in Germany. I think they did still get a guarantee that they were not going to be subject to torture first, but they're sending them home. You look at the same time, the German army are deploying deployed onto the streets as part of a military exercise for the first time since World War II. So you were starting to see quite a few firsts when it comes to domestic security, within Germany. And that's part of an important change of attitude when it comes to radical Islam.
Well, it is an important trend. Like you mentioned a couple of other dots that we're connecting here and seeing the way that this is playing out. And we would suspect that this is the first of more of these kind, well, not the first, but another of more of these kinds of accommodations that would be made to try to deal with this threat. And you see, and we've been talking about just how politically Europe is shifting to the right in order to accommodate the public's desire to deal more robustly with these threats. So this is hard evidence of that trend from a policy standpoint, from a law enforcement standpoint, which is really interesting to see. Well, we appreciate that, Richard. And we're going to go now to the United States. The process is underway to fulfill the Supreme Court justice seat vacated by Antonin Scalia's death last year. It's turned into a pretty heated battle as hearings for nominee Judge Neil Gorsuch have been proceeding. To learn about this, we're going to go to Andrew Miller.
It's definitely a huge issue here in America. This is probably one of the two biggest issues that got Donald Trump elected was his promise to clamp down on illegal immigration and his promise to appoint a constitutional originalist to the Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. And he picked a really well-qualified constitutional originalist, Neil Gorsuch, as his nominee. And as could be expected, he had his confirmation hearings this week. I believe they ended yesterday, and had a bit of a rough go of it. I think the Democratic minority leader Chuck Schumer had, by the end of it, he said that he cannot endorse the confirmation of Gorsuch and would encourage all Democrats to also not endorse the confirmation of Gorsuch, meaning that they're looking at the filibuster option, just keep talking until the congressional session runs out. The only way to override that is a 60% majority in Congress, in the Senate. And so it would mean the Republicans would need to convince 8 Democrats to vote with them for this, which is not likely to happen. So now there's looking at the options of doing, I guess, what they call the nuclear option, where you'd have to do a little bit of a rule change, but for a Supreme Court nominee, but to be able to just do a simple majority to get bypass that. So I think, and in my opinion, at least, it looks like they probably will still get him nominated, but it's going to be a kind of a drawn out, messy procedure. But I think just the really interesting thing to bring to our listeners this week is just kind of like the rationale of why, mm-hmm. of why he's so controversial. That actually went from one of his Wednesday hearings. They had this is a question from Senator Dianne Feinstein that really just shows why the left in America hates him so much. And this is her question. She says, "You are a self-professed originalist in your approach to constitutional interpretation. For example, you wrote, and I quote, 'Judges should instead strive, if humanly and so imperfectly, to imply the law as it is, focusing backward, not forward, and looking to text, structure, and history to decide what a reasonable reader at the time of the events in question would have understood the law to be.'"
Mm-hmm. Which is absolutely true. I mean, like the idea that a citizen should be able to live his life and, you know, his interaction with the law is as it is understood at the time that he's acting, not retroactively decided upon by a judge who says, "Well, no, actually the law meant this at some later date."
Right. That's the point, is that if you don't like the law and you want a new law, you can pass new laws, but it needs to be passed by an elected representative of the people in Congress. The Supreme Court's not in the or shouldn't be in the business of making new laws. They're not elected. They're just supposed to be interpreters. Like, what does the law already say? Mm-hmm. But she continues the question after Gorsuch would have agreed. He said that, and he still sticks by that. But she continues the question. She says, "Now, do you agree with Justice Scalia's assessment that originalism means there is no protection for women or gays or lesbians under the Equal Protection Law because it was not the intent or the understanding of those who drafted the 14th Amendment in 1868? Which is enlightening on at least two points. Is the first of all, she's actually, because they had the recent Supreme Court decision where they basically invented a right to homosexual marriage based on the 14th Amendment's promise that the government won't discriminate against a natural-born citizen. But she's taken that and make it look like, said, okay, well, at the time, well, first of all, she's admitted that the 14th Amendment, at the time it was written, didn't have anything to do with homosexual marriage. Right. That's something the Supreme Court justices just made up and read into after the fact. But she also really mischaracterizes the 14th Amendment and the fact that it doesn't offer no protection, quote unquote, no protection from women or homosexuals or lesbians. It offers them the exact same protection it offers everybody else.
Yep.
It just doesn't offer them any special protections. I guess that's one of the probably most succinct arguments you've heard against the Supreme Court case on homosexual marriage. It's like, said a homosexual man has always had the right to get married in the United States. He can marry any woman who's desperate enough to have him. But the idea that you're redefining marriage as something that it wasn't previously, that's obviously, there's a biblical reasons you wouldn't do that. But just from a purely legal standpoint, that's not a judge's job to decide those things. That's for legislatures to decide.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like I said, in this question, she's really trying to beat Gorsuch over the head over this because he interprets things like the 14th Amendment to mean what they meant when they were passed instead of the living Constitution interpretation that, like, oh, well, I want to redefine marriage, therefore I'm going to read, based on my own judgment, a meaning into this amendment or to this law that it never had until I just decided it did 8 seconds ago.
What we're really seeing, in a sense, in these hearings is this whole argument over the living Constitution play out in public discourse in a way that it's very very open and out there. What we've been talking about, that our editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, made mention of back in 2000 over the election between Al Gore and George W. Bush, where he was talking about this idea that the Constitution is this evolving thing. He wrote a chapter of it a chapter about this went into the booklet No Freedom Without Law that explained the danger in this way of thinking. But even just looking at it from the standpoint of a citizen who needs to be able to know that the way that he's conducting himself under the law is that there's a certain amount of stability there, that he's not going to be judged according to laws that haven't been passed yet or interpretations of laws that haven't been codified yet. That's just a basic principle of the rule of law that a citizen of a free country must be able to do that is under threat by the way that Feinstein and these other liberals are interpreting.
Right. And it's been, since the 1940s, this trend towards judicial activism and legislating from the bench has been growing in America. But this more recent confirmations probably is just like as out there, bold in your face as I've ever seen, where before you kind of try to have some subtlety as you're changing laws to where now you actually have like a U.S. senator who's saying that, like, well, we're going to filibuster this nominee because he says, I'm going to interpret what the law says, not what I want the law to say.
Yeah. Yeah. It reminds me as well of the section in the America Under Attack book where Gerald Fleury goes back into the Bork nomination in 1986 and shows how 86, 87 and shows how this type of thinking is what is exactly what took Judge Bork down and prevented him from being able to make his way onto the Supreme Court. Very dangerous. We appreciate that, Andrew. This is Trumpet Hour. You can visit us online and the new improved trumpet.com and read the stories that we've been talking about. Most of everything that we've discussed on the program today, we've written into article form and put it up on the website. And go check it out. It, not only will you get the information and more context, but we point back to past articles and booklets and things that can really give you a thorough education in the importance of these events. We're going to finish the program next with our lightning round of important news. That's coming up next.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
It's time now for our lightning round. We'll take one last look at some headlines that caught our attention from this week, and we'll start with Brent.
Israel and the United States failed to reach a deal on West Bank settlement construction during 4 days of high-level talks in Washington. That finished on Thursday. There was a joint statement released by the both delegations saying this: the United States delegation reiterated President Donald Trump's concerns regarding settlement activity in the context of moving towards a peace agreement. Then the Israeli delegation added that they made clear that Israel's intent going forward is to adopt a policy regarding settlement activity that takes those concerns into a consideration, that is Israeli concerns. It's interesting because we thought again that Mr. Trump was going to side with the Israelis, yet even after 4 days of intense level talks, they weren't able to come to some agreement on how Israel would go forward with its settlements.
Let's go now to Jeremiah.
China now has more than 100 cities with over 1 million residents. We often hear about places like Beijing, Shanghai, and Hong Kong, but we don't hear very much about places like Kaifeng, Kanzhou, and Gongyang. And these all have over 1 million people. The Demographic Research Group published a report on March 20th showing that there are now 102 Chinese cities with more than 1 million residents. Just for comparison, America has only 10 cities with over 1 million. And what's even more remarkable is that within a decade, this number will double and China will have 200 of such cities.
Wow. Let's go to Richard.
Bavaria State Premier Horst Seehofer took his good friend Edmund Stoiber, the former premier, to visit Russian President Vladimir Putin March 16th. It's another of a whole series of meetings between the leaders of Bavaria and Russia, and you can see this kind of budding relationship with an alternative political power group within Germany building with Russia.
All right, to Andrew.
A Maryland high school has been dragged into the national immigration debate this week after a 14-year-old girl was raped in the men's bathroom by two students who had entered the United States illegally from Central America. There have been protesters on both sides of the debate converging on the school yesterday during a visit by U.S. Education Secretary Betsy DeVos. The White House has weighed in saying that atrocities like this are why President Trump's trying to crack down on immigration, though the school superintendent has defended the actions of the school by saying that they're not actually allowed to ask about students' immigration status.
All right, back to Brent.
U.S. Navy commanders accused Iran of jeopardizing international navigation by again harassing warships in the Strait of Hormuz. Two sets of Iranian Navy fast attack boats, they approached the U.S.-led five-vessel flotilla, including the U.S. aircraft carrier George H.W. Bush, as it entered the strait just on Tuesday. This aircraft carrier sent helicopter gunships to hover over the Iranian speedboats, and as they were there over the top of them, they saw that there were weaponry that was uncovered, some of it armed, and some of it was manned. This is just one of the first indications after President Donald Trump came into office that the Strait of Hormuz and the Persian Gulf would not be getting any reprieve from American and Iranian actions.
And Jeremiah.
South Korean President Park Geun-hye was removed from office a few weeks ago, and the nation will be voting for her successor soon. And the man projected to win and become the next president is Moon Jae-in. And he said that if he wins, he would like to review South Korea's decision to let the United States operate its THAAD missile defense system on South Korean soil. And if they dismantled that THAAD system, it would be a massive defeat for the U.S. and its allies and a huge victory for China, Russia, and North Korea, and it would make Asia and the world a lot more dangerous.
All right, let's hear Richard.
Returning to Bavaria, former German Defense Minister Karl Theodor zu Guttenberg had a meeting on March 11th with party leaders where it was decided he was going to actively campaign during the next election. He will be holding campaigns in each of the 7 Bavarian government districts in the weeks leading up. But because he was resigned in disgrace, they're ready to pull him if he's not popular. So it's a very useful testing of the waters for a man the Trumpet's been watching for a long time.
Back to Brent.
Referring to the nuclear deal, Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Zarif said on Monday that Iran is, quote, fully prepared to return to the pre-nuclear deal situation or even to conditions more robust than that if the United States reneges on its promises to the extent that the nuclear deal's continuation harms our national interests. Basically, he said, if the United States is going to put these sanctions that they're discussing right now in the U.S. Congress on Iran, that they're very happy to go forward go back to the nuclear arrangement that existed before, that is, Iran's freedom to develop nuclear weapons. He said, at present, we possess the know-how to manufacture and use centrifuges with enrichment capacity 20 times faster than those of previous centrifuges.
And over to Andrew.
According to a new paper published by the American Journal of Preventative Medicine, people who spend more than 2 hours a day on social media accounts are twice as likely to experience feelings of social isolation and loneliness compared to those who spend less than half an hour a day. This is concerning news, as the average American spends 1 hour and 54 minutes on social media every day, and many American teenagers spend up to 9 hours a day on social platforms.
That's crazy. Over to Richard.
Around 40 German companies were in Bolivia earlier this week for discussions about building a $10 billion, 2,300-mile railway across South America. It would link the two coastlines through Peru, Bolivia, and Brazil, and is the latest example of a major infrastructure project that would bring Europe and Latin America closer together and deepen economic ties between the two.
And we'll finish with Jeremiah.
Russians are living longer. As of last year, the average Russian is living to be almost 72 years old. That's still a little bit lower than most Western nations, but it's way up from where it was 12 years ago. Back in 2005, the average Russian lived to be only about 65 and a half years old. So they're now living 6.5 years longer on average, and that number is expected to keep on climbing. These gains have occurred under President Putin's watch, so it'll be just one more factor that makes the people of Russia lend their full support to Vladimir Putin.
Thanks for that, gentlemen. I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Visit thetrumpet.com to read the stories we talked about today. You can give us your feedback by emailing us at letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal.
Goodbye.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
Thanks to our staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with the words of John Wayne. Courage is being scared to death, but saddling up anyway. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.